Tonight on Arena, Kellyanne Byrne on the life and artistry of Prince, and Stephen Benedict on David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we start this Wednesday with the news that reached us this morning of the death of Jim Steinman, one of the most successful and sonically identifiable producers and writers of his age. Sirens are screaming and the fires are howling, way down in the valley tonight. There's a man in the shadows with a gun in his eye and a blade shining no so bright. There's evil in the air, and there's thunder in the sky, and a killer's on the bloodshot streets. Oh, I'm down in the tunnel with a deadly horizon. Oh, I swear I saw a young boy down in the gutter. He was stopping the foam in the heat. As writer of songs like A Bat Out of Hell and producer of songs like Total Eclipse of the Heart, Steinman's music encapsulated the bombast of rock music in the 1970s and 80s and led to record sales of over 190 million. Here's a reporter from the 1970s putting a question to Meatloaf, who immediately bounces that question onto Jim Steinman, who's sitting next to him.
How do you describe your style of music?
Jimmy, describe our style of music.
How do I describe my style of music?
Good, Jimmy. Get right in there. Jump on in, Jimmy.
I describe it as feverish, strong, romantic, violent, rebellious, fun and heroic.
Not much left, is there? Jim Steinman there describing the 1970s bombastic rock sound he developed, achieving his greatest success with Meatloaf, who you also heard in that interview. Pat Carty has been taking a look at the impact of Jim Steinman, the impact that he made on rock music. He really does describe, he throws every word in as that descriptor, everything but the kitchen sink into the descriptor of his own music. But the big thing, I think, that if we start out with his background in music theatre, that kind of defines what he brought to rock music, Pat.
Yeah, I suppose it does. I think what he left out there was maybe Wagnerian and a bit pompous and deliberately kitsch, I suppose, as well. He had this background, as you say, in musical theatre, right from when he was in college. And a lot of the themes that he was working on, he starts off working on Brechtian theatre, which might seem odd. But he writes a thing called The Dream Engine in 1969. And that has the frankly ridiculous monologue from the start, if you took the words right out of my mouth. You know the one that goes, on a hot summer night, would you offer your throat to the wolf with the red roses? That's in that. Turn Around Bright Eyes, which we'll come to later on, is also in that. Mm. So right from the start, he had all these things as he was working towards his masterwork at the end of the 70s.
Yeah, well, I mean, even in the two lyrics that you gave us there, you give us a sense of the hits that he either wrote or produced, or did both. I mean, he had huge success.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's talk about the obvious elephant in the room. Bat Out of Hell in 1977. Bat Out of Hell sold something like 50 million copies around the world. So if you divide that by the number of people in Ireland, what's that, about 9 copies for everybody living here? And it did seem like everyone had about 9 copies of it back in the day as well, because you could find it in every house in Ireland, as far as I could tell, back in the 70s and 80s.
And obviously there's Bat Out of Hell. And you can hear in that clip as well that himself and Meatloaf, they got on very well together. But it was a tempestuous enough relationship, up and down, in and out.
No, it was. Yeah, they started off. The whole thing came from, they started working on a thing called a Neverland musical about Peter Pan, obviously. And that morphed into Bat Out of Hell. And then they made a second one, which was Back Into Hell, which was the follow-up to it. And then, Meat, if I can call him that, fell in some hard times. He ended up, I think I saw him in Moat playing one time. And but eventually they wanted to make the third one. That was the point where Jim said, listen, that's enough. And there was court cases and everything. But eventually he got to do it, recording some of Steinman's songs. So, yeah, as you say, up and down.
Yeah,
money,
and certainly, Meatloaf expressing great sadness today at the death of Jim.
Oh, I'm
Steinman.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
Subsequent to the Bat Out of Hell, which really was the big breakthrough for Steinman, worked with people like Celine Dion, Andrew Lloyd Webber. What sort of collaborations were involved there?
Well, with Andrew Lloyd Webber, that's a bit of a strange one, because he was asked apparently to do the lyrics for Phantom of the Opera. So he claimed. Well, what he was doing, he was working with Bonnie Tyler at the time. And of course, Bonnie Tyler is the other big hits that he had. And then he went on to work on a play that was called, a musical called Whistle Down the Wind. And he wrote the lyrics for that. Now, it didn't do that well, but out of it, came his last proper hit, and maybe we shouldn't remember him this way, but that was No Matter What by Boyzone in 1998, which actually was a hit in America and came from that Notting Hill movie. Now, with Celine Dion, he had a song that Meatloaf had wanted to record, and he wouldn't let him. And when it came to her, what is the name of this album? Sorry, I'm after losing it here. It's All Coming Back to Me Now is the name of the song. And this is in 1996. So he had stopped. He had actually held on to the song for ages. Meatloaf wanted to do it. And then that was on her Falling Into You album, which roughly sold about half a bazillion copies, I think, all over the world. So yeah. Pretty successful, yeah.
Yeah, and he himself, Jim Steinman himself, speaks about Bonnie Tyler and Total Eclipse of the Heart as the song of which he's most proud. Now, let go of the opening lyrics, which you're not too fond of, Pat. This is what Steinman could do, yeah, isn't it?
The only thing I would say is that he gave a great memory to me and loads of people in Ireland, because a couple of years ago at the Electric Picnic, Bonnie Tyler turns up, and the opening bars of this song came on, and hats and pants and beer glasses and everything went in the air. Fantastic memory. So thanks for that, Jim, if nothing else. If you only hold me tight, we'll be holding on forever, and we'll only be making it right, cause we'll never be wrong. Together we can take it to the end of the line. The love is like a shadow on me all of the time. All the time. I don't know what to do, and I'm always in the dark. We're living in a powder keg and giving up ball. I really need you tonight. Forever's gonna start tonight. Forever's gonna start tonight. Upon a time I was falling in love, but now I'm only falling apart. There's nothing I can do.
Total Eclipse of the Heart from Bonnie Tyler, and that one of the huge hits from the composer and producer Jim Steinman, whose death was announced, came to us early this morning. He was 83, and that brings us to 14 minutes past 7 on Wednesday night's Arena.
Please let me look. I happen to be a doctor.
That's very kind of you.
Oh, turn around the light, please.
Keep still, you little devil, or I'll cut your throat.
Please, sir, I want some more.
I hope that the people who use this bridge in years to come will remember how it was built and who built it.
Glory be to God. Why must there be? Because Rosie Ryan wants it?
The personal life is dead in Russia. History has killed it.
My Lord Faisal already has an Englishman.
Yes.
What is your name?
My name is for my friends.
Famous lines there from Brief Encounter, Great Expectations, Oliver Twist, Bridge on the River Kwai, Ryan's Daughter, Dr. Zhivago and Lawrence Arabia, and of course the music from Lawrence Arabia at the very end as well. All of them directed by David Lean, the celebrated director, died 30 years ago this month, and to mark the occasion we're looking back at what is widely regarded as his greatest work, Lawrence of Arabia. Just before I get into that, did I say that Jim Steinman was 83? He was 73. He died today, 73. But let's come back to David Lean. 16 films we're talking about here, but he received a staggering 11 Oscar nominations within those 16 films, not just for directing, also for writing and editing. Besides Oscars, he won BAFTAs, Golden Globes, Directors Guild of America Awards, AFI Lifetime Achievement Award, as well as the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. Born in 1908, cinematic inspirations came from the silent era, but since then, the likes of Stanley Kubrick, Steven Spielberg, Spike Lee, Christopher Nolan have all revered him as the poet of the far horizon. Stephen Benedict has been taking a look back at the extraordinary accomplishments of David Lean, in particular, the classic Lawrence of Arabia. The poet of the far horizon, just to tease that out a little bit for me and how that applies specifically to David Lean, Stephen.
I think it was because David Lean was an unbridled romantic, you know, as a romantic and as a great visionary. What separated him from other directors was the way he used the camera. Other directors used the camera to show us what is there. But as a romantic, David Lean used the camera to show us what was not there. Now, just give me a second to explain that. He visualized the emotion. It was where Lean put the camera. It was where he pointed it, is how he framed the shots, positioned his characters across the screen, how he lit them, the lenses he used. And that entire composition suggested something that was not there. And that something was love, it was freedom, or another life. So if you think of Dr. Zhivago, and you think of Yuri out on the Russian steppes searching for Lara, or you mentioned Ryan's daughter, young Rosie Ryan alone on the beach yearning for a life of passion. Or if you go back to one of Lean's early films, Brief Encounter, you have Laura Jessens alone in the train station hoping her lover will come back. That is the far horizon. So, you know, you suggested, and I agree with you, Lawrence of Arabia is Lean's outstanding achievement. But when it comes to the far horizon in Lawrence, the far horizon represents a man in search of himself.
And I guess that whole, you know, to stick with the image of the poet of the far horizon, of course, you can never reach the horizon because when you go to where it is from where you're standing right now, it's 100 miles away again.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, it's something that you're always looking for. And if you do happen to find it, it's only temporary or it's an illusion. And in the case of Lawrence, it's a mirage. You know, and here's the thing. David Lean made Lawrence in 62 and he made it in 1962 and he made it in the widescreen format. The widescreen format emerged in the early 1950s, in 1953 in particular, for a biblical epic called The Robe. And it was designed to combat the growing competition of television. And the new format of the widescreen revived the historical epic, which would be replete with a cast of thousands. So if you think of films like Ben-Hur or Demetrius and the Gladiators or Spartacus, the thing was, with the emergence of the widescreen format, very, very few directors knew how to use the widescreen. So what they did was they just put the camera back from the action, from the dialogue scenes, and they just let the characters talk to one another and they framed them from head to toe. But with Lawrence of Arabia, David Lean went in the complete opposite direction. Frequently, he took everyone out of the frame, leaving just one man on a camel alone in the desert. And so when the movie was released in 1962, he was held in awe by his peers, by especially the American directors, William Wyler, Fred Cinnamon, John Ford, all, I hasten to add, multi-Oscar winners. And it wasn't, but it wasn't just the imagery that they were stunned by. It was David Lean's nerve. There was by which I mean the pacing of the film. Hopefully we'll be able to talk about the editing in a minute, but it's the pacing in addition to the framing that compounds the feeling of emptiness, of yearning, you know. And the thing is,
I suppose in some ways, where better to do that and to make a film like that and to be talking about Far Horizons than in a desert?
Perfectly. And that's the reason why they shot in the widescreen format, because it wouldn't be half as effective if they shot it on the 1.66 or 1.78 aspect ratio. And it's more than just romanticism in David Lean's life. He was an absolute fanatic in pursuit of perfection. He spent up to 15 months in the Jordanian desert shooting the movie. And he was getting as few as 6 takes a day. I'm not talking about six different shots. I'm talking about 6 different takes on one shot. Because you've got to remember, this is the days before CGI. This is not a computer-generated desert we're looking at.
Yeah.
So every time they went to take a shot and they went for take 2, they'd have to have the crew to go out and wipe the sand clean, the dunes clean of all the footsteps of everybody.
Yeah.
And it took so long, as I said, he was 15 months in the desert. If you were to make the movie under the same circumstances today, it's estimated that it would cost in the region of $300 million.
Wow. That's quite a budget. you're talking about here that, you know, he was this fanaticism and this that he constantly wanted to have everything absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
We're also, in the case of Lawrence of Arabia, we're not dealing with a fictional character here. We're dealing with an historical character, and we're in the realm of the historic epic. Is there anything to worry about in terms of his historical accuracy here, or is that, you know, a worthless avenue to go down when we're talking about the film?
No, well, I think in particular in these days, and looking back and the construction of the modern Arab world, we've got to be very sensitive to the fact that there are huge inaccuracies in the film. And it's not only in the film. I mean, Lawrence's own memoir, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, is full of exaggerations and embroideries of the truth. But in terms of the film, it wasn't laziness on the part of the filmmakers that they just wanted to do something spectacular. It was really David Lean's interpretation of Lawrence's life. Lawrence was, you know, someone who was very, very uncomfortable in his own skin. He was, if I can just list these things off, he was an Englishman born out of wedlock in Wales to an Irish aristocrat, Sir Thomas Chapman. But he took his mother's maiden name, Lawrence. And then during World War One, when he went out and took part in the Arab revolt in the desert, he was hailed as a hero by the Arab tribes and they called him Orence. And that adulation prompted Lawrence to swap his British Army uniform for Arab robes. And those are the most famous photographs of him in bedecked in these Arab robes. But after the war, Lawrence then changed his name twice to John Hume Ross and T.E. Shaw. And Lean was fascinated by the shifting identity. And if you think about it, you know, the most telling, for me, the most telling moment about the identity, it comes halfway through the picture when Lawrence treks back across the desert to the Suez Canal and he stops at the canal and there's a man on the opposite side of the water and he yells out, "Who are you?" Now, that voice was dubbed in by none other than David Lean himself.
Oh, wow. That's an extraordinary detail. So he was the director was shouting this question out at the yeah. character who had even those shifts of identity. First of all, the background, the numerous aspects of identity that go into that background. English man, Wales, Irish aristocrat, you know.
Yeah.
There's so much in that. Never mind the changes in name. But Lean actually gives us a hint. Here's the question I'm asking in this film. Who are you? And does the widescreen imagery, how does it feed into that questioning and that search for identity, do you think?
Well, as I said, it's the emptiness, but it's not just the widescreen. It's the pristine, you know, if you think about the robes that Lawrence appears in the movie, you know, they're pristine white robes, but they don't belong to any particular Arab tribe. It's not the Bedouin, it's not the Hawitat. And then over the course of the movie, the robes become thinner and thinner and thinner until we can actually see through them. And that's a conscious decision on Lean's part, because what he's doing is he's stripping away the legend and replacing it with an illusion. If you think of that wonderful scene where they blow up the train and then Lawrence walks along the top of the train, what Lean does is we see him first in shadow and then we see him silhouetted against the sun. So, you know, what Lean is doing, he's actually obliterating the real man and presenting this mirage. And in picking up on what you were saying earlier, I would argue, you know, that Lawrence of Arabia is actually a character study disguised as an historical epic.
Right. Well, let's listen to a clip that I think will give a reinforce in some ways what you're saying there. Jack Hawkins as General Allenby here, and of course Peter O'Toole as Lawrence.
There it is up on the screen in 70mm, and
sorry, that's the wrong one. This is the one I wanted.
The truth is, I'm an ordinary man. You might have told me that, Drayton. And I want an ordinary job, sir. That's my reason for resigning. It's personal.
Personal?
Yes, sir.
Personal? You're a serving officer in the field, and as it happens, a damned important one. Personal? Are you mad?
No. And if you don't mind, I'd rather not go mad. That's my reason, too.
Look, Lawrence. I'm making my big push on Damascus the 16th of next month, and you are part of it. Can you understand that? You're an important part of the big push.
I don't want to be part of your big push.
What about your Arab friends? What about them?
I have no Arab friends. I don't want Arab friends.
Jack Hawkins and Peter O'Toole in Lawrence of Arabia, David Lean's film. We're speaking about this evening with Stephen Benedict. You know, I kind of gave away where I'm heading with this next with this next set of questions around the influence and the directors who were influenced by this particular movie. Hitchcock, Kubrick, Godard, Fellini, they've all spoken about it. But you've also found a particular Irish director that you think was influenced here, Stephen.
Well, no, this was more the influence, somebody who actually influenced David Lean.
Oh, himself. Sorry, I beg your pardon, my mistake.
Yeah, the great thing here is there was a director called Rex Ingram, and he was one of the biggest Hollywood directors in the 1920s, in the silent era. Mm. And Ingram was actually born here in Dublin, in Rathmines. And in 1921, he directed one of the biggest hits of the silent era, a film called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And when Lean saw that as a young man, he was greatly impressed with the romanticism of it, the sweep of it. And then there was two other movies that Ingram directed, Mare Nostrum in 1926, and 2 years earlier, a movie called The Arab. And in fact, Ingram himself wanted to buy, he approached Lawrence to buy the film rights to this, to Lawrence's life story, but Lawrence said no.
And Ingram himself is another man that brings up a whole series of questions around identity and shifting identities as well. You wanted to talk about the editing. You said it's as important as anything else in this film, Stephen.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, David Lean was a great editor before he became a film director, feature film director. And so when he came to direct his own feature films, he worked very, very closely with the editors. But the thing is, when it came to Lawrence, he was actually away in the desert in Jordan. So he actually couldn't see the rushes. He was in the desert in such remote areas that he actually couldn't sit down to watch the rushes. The rushes were sent back to London. And there's a lady called Anne V. Coates, and she was clearly one of the best directors in Britain at the time, and this elevated her to be a legendary status as a director, as an editor. The amazing thing was, at the very same time that she was asked by David Lean to cut Lawrence, she was approached by Stanley Kubrick. And she said no, and she fobbed him off by recommending one of her assistants. But the thing was, while Lean was off in the desert shooting this movie, Anne V. Coates was back in London, and she was looking at the rushes, but she was also going to the cinema, and she was watching these new French films by these new young French directors, François Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard, and they had unleashed this new technique called the jump cut. And the jump cut was designed deliberately to disrupt the smooth flow of the story. And what Coates did was, she was in contact with Lean, explaining to him, you know, how about this idea, and she encouraged him and convinced him to adapt the jump cut, to use it as a hard cut to transition from one sequence or one scene to the other. Because in the script, Lean had specified that the transitions had to be dissolves. Now, if we think about the most famous cut in Lawrence, is one of the most famous cuts in all of cinema, is when Lawrence blows out the match. It's called the match cut. And so Anne V. Coates is the person who said, let's cut from the match going out to the rising sun. Now, if you just go back to Kubrick for a second, this gets funny. Anne V. Coates declined his invitation, and she recommended her assistant, and his name was Ray Lovejoy. 6 years later, Ray Lovejoy is editing 2001 for Stanley Kubrick. And what do you see in that movie but an ape hurling the bone up into the air, and there's a hard cut to a spaceship floating above the Earth. So there we have Stanley Kubrick being influenced by David Lean and taking Anne V. Coates' cue.
All right. Well, you're talking there about, as I mistakenly talked about influences. Those were influences on him, including Rex Ingram. Let's talk about people he influenced. And I gave a little bit of the game away earlier when I started this clip.
There it is up on the screen in 70mm. And the main character is not Ben-Hur. It's not a saint. It's not a man struggling to come to terms with God in his soul and in his heart. It's a character that really, in a way, comes out of a B-movie, I think. A man is really filled with a noir, in a way. He's filled with self-destruction and self-loathing, I think, you see. This is fascinating to me. And he's constantly testing himself, pushing himself. Yeah. Putting his finger on the flame is just one thing, but then going through the desert and going back out. What is he trying to prove? What is he fighting about himself?
Martin Scorsese there on Lawrence of Arabia. And you can, if you listen to that clip, you can really hear how it fed into so many of his films in so many different ways. But I need to finish up with the music. I gave a little taster of it at the beginning of the item, Stephen. It's such a wonderful, epic sweep. It really does match the epic sweep of both the story and the visuals that David Lean gives us in the film.
Yeah, and there's there's an unbridled romanticism in there. It was composed by Maurice Jarre. It wasn't his first, but the thing was, he wasn't the first choice that David Lean had. David Lean had originally wanted to approach Aram Khachaturian to do the score, but the Soviet authorities refused Khachaturian the permission to leave. So Jarre had to step in very, very late in the day, and he composed over an hour's worth of music in a month. And his diktat that he said this to all composers, for music, music must give the film an added dimension. It must say things that are not seen on the screen nor heard in the dialogue. And that, you can see, there's a perfect match between what Lean was doing as well. It's a superb score, incredibly romantic and incredibly evocative of the expanse of the desert.
Unbridled romanticism, indeed, the music of Maurice Jarre there and the main theme from Lawrence of Arabia. It was Stephen Benedict who was speaking to us about David Lean's film, Lawrence of Arabia. 5 years since his death at the age of 57, Prince Rogers Nelson's light hasn't dimmed. He released more than 30 albums and won 7 Grammy Awards over a 40-year career. In the hours and days after the news broke on this day in 2016, fans around the world mourned his death. In a statement at the time, President Obama said, "Few artists have influenced the sound and trajectory of popular music more distinctly or touched quite so many people with their talent." Joining me this evening to mark Prince's 5th anniversary is Kelly Ann Byrne. He was such a talented artist, but it was a kind of, there was a constant striving for perfection, Kelly Ann, and that goes right back to his early, to his childhood and his background at home.
Absolutely. So Prince was raised in a very musical family. His father was a jazz pianist and his mother was a jazz singer. And the story goes that he would sit with his dad, who never let him play the piano on his own. And the father would say, "Do it again, do it again, do it again." And so it was almost like being in the army. And although that sounds cruel to us, Prince says that this is the reason why years later he became such a great musician, was down to his dad, who was his first teacher. And he wrote his first song when he was just 7 years old.
I know. Yeah. And not only that, you're saying that the dad would sit beside him when he was practicing piano. The dad must have sat beside him beside many when he was playing many instruments. He was hugely talented, multi-instrumentalist.
He was hugely talented. Like his first album, which he released when he was just 17, For You, he played all 27 instruments, wrote, arranged and produced it. And the first demo he recorded, this story is brilliant, was sent to his future manager, Owen Husney. And apparently the story goes that Husney was listening and he was saying, you know, "God, this drummer is great. And you know, this guitarist is fantastic. This singer is perfect. Who are these guys?" And Owen Moon, who he'd recorded the demo with, said, "This is one person. He's 16 years old and he plays everything and he sings everything and he arranges everything." So by the age of 16, Prince was known in Minneapolis as a young Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, and hardly surprising. Hits came, I suppose, one of the big, first big hits was I Want to Be Your Lover from 1979 album Prince. But in 1982, we had an album containing this song. There you go, there's the advice. There's he telling us what he's going to do. He's going to party like it's 1999. We're celebrating and remembering Prince this evening on the 5th anniversary of his death. Kelly Ann Byrne with us. And you listen to that song, and if you don't listen closely, you think, yeah, there it is. Prince, as usual, telling us to get up on the floor and dance and go out and party. But there's more going on, Kelly Ann, than that.
Yes, absolutely. There's so much more to that track. Actually, that track was written about the threat of nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And the whole idea was live life to the fullest because we could all drop dead tomorrow. And I didn't even realise that myself till I watched a documentary last night. So, a really interesting one.
That was 1982 when we got the album, which was also called 1999. The lyric that we hear in the song, 1999. He's only 23 at this point in time. I mean, and
he's 23.
Has he five albums behind him at this stage?
Five critically acclaimed albums under his belt. I mean, that's just phenomenal. You would never hear of that nowadays. So, and yet still the best was yet to come with Purple Rain in 1984, because Purple Rain really, it was the commercial peak. And as a songwriter, it showed how sophisticated he was. It embraced so many different genres. So even people who knocked Prince prior to that, because, you know, because of the way he looked and the sexually explicit lyrics, went, "Oh my God, this guy is a genius."
Yeah, the sexually explicit lyrics were there back in the 1981 album in particular, or I suppose the 1980 album, Dirty Mind. And controversy came then in 1981. But this kind of, this shifting identity, this gender fluidity that certainly I think is often ascribed to him, whether it was there or not is another detail. It's all part of the enigma of Prince.
Absolutely. Like, if you look at the earlier footage, Sean, he's wearing thigh-high boots, women's underpants, a shoulder padded jacket, dancing around the stage, not a care in the world. And Prince broke every boundary in that sense. He said he was looking for the ledge as a young artist and to see how far he could go. And so when you're looking at him, you're thinking, is, you know, man, woman, is he gay, is he straight? That was written in the words of Controversy. I can't understand all the things people say. Am I black or white? Am I straight or gay? And he always kept people guessing. And you're dead right. Gender fluidity wasn't even discussed then. Mm. And here was this guy who just, you know, embraced both sexes. It was just incredible to look at, I feel.
The commercial peak, I suppose, was 1984. You've already mentioned that both the song and the album, the 3 Grammys, an Oscar, because there was a film made of this as well. So let's have a listen to the track that was part of that commercial peak. Purple rain. Such a good song, Purple Rain, from 1984. Prince died 5 years ago today. Kellyanne Byrne speaking to us about his life and work. There's a great story around that song, not in 1984 when the album came out, but more recently than that, 2007, in fact, Kellyanne, at the Super Bowl.
Yes, yes. Okay, so if you want to, we all know he was one of the best live performers of all time. And in 2007, he played the halftime at the Super Bowl. 40 million people were watching. Mm. And the story goes, it started to rain very heavily. So production were panicking because, first of all, the stage was made of tiles and he was in his high heels with his dancers and they were thinking he's going to break his neck, he's going to get electrocuted. And so they go to Prince and they say, look, it's really raining heavily out there. And he goes, make it rain harder. And when you watch that footage, anyone who's listening now, please look at the YouTube clip because there's something, like he's just like drenched. There's something really mind-blowing about the performance. He had this way of making even disadvantages work for him in live performances. That's how talented he was.
Important to talk about the number of women that he had, both in his kind of all around him in terms of the work, both in management and the technical side of things and in performance.
100%. He always had women, like you say, so in the band. I mean, there was Gail Chapman, Wendy and Lisa in The Revolution, Sheila E., the drummer, Cat Glover, the dancer, Rosie Gaines, Third Eye Girl. And when you look at a Prince concert or you look at the videos, that's what I remember as a little girl thinking, God, look at his drummer, like she's a woman. Look at the guitar, like they're women, they're powerful, strong women. And if you were somebody that wanted to be in a band or wanted to be a performer, you could identify with that and think, I can do that too. And that's really not something anyone at the time was doing. And I don't really feel anyone has done that since.
And when it comes to perhaps one of his most, what you think of his most romantic songs, certainly the way Sinead O'Connor sings, is you think of it as a highly romantic song. The woman for whom he wrote this song is maybe not who you would think.
Yes. Yeah, so nothing compares to you. Everybody thought it was either about a lover or his mom. But actually, the story goes he wrote it about his housekeeper, Sandy. And she did everything for him. She'd have flowers on his piano. She'd make his dinner. She'd, you know, do his laundry. And this woman, her father got really ill and she had to go back to the Deep South. And he was devastated. And that's what he wrote the track about. Well, so it shows how sensitive he was.
Yeah, an amazing. Yeah. What a song to write about somebody who had been so close to him in that way, in a way that you wouldn't expect. Finally, we'll finish up with Sign of the Times, which you think this is, for you, the highlight of Prince's career, Kellyanne?
This is the pinnacle for me. I feel like this is his Songs in the Key of Life or What's Going On. This album, every time I go back to it, it just blows my mind. I find something new in it. It's musically so experimental. He embraced every kind of genre. It's one of the best records ever written, hands down.
I'm guessing that you still miss him because you are not only, as we can hear, not only are you a font of knowledge about him, but you're a huge fan, Kellyanne.
Yeah, I do miss him. And but it's funny, Sean, like it's 5 years now. I was really gutted when I heard the news. I had to go on air 15 minutes later on TXFM and I played Prince all night and I really sobbed and the listeners got me through it. That said, I've been watching interviews with him in the latter part of his life and he had great faith and he said he wasn't afraid of dying. In actual fact, he was going to celebrate the day he died. He was a Jehovah's Witness. So now, having seen those interviews, that's what I think about. I think about, well, he wasn't afraid to die. So that's a good way to think about it. He believed he was going somewhere else. That was even more special.
Let's finish with Sign of the Times. You turn on the telly and every other story is telling you somebody died. My sister killed a baby because she couldn't afford to feed it. It was sending people to the moon. In September, my cousin tried reefer for the very first time. Now he's doing horse. It's June. Sign of the Times, lead single from Prince's 1987 album of the same name, and it was Kellyanne Byrne who was remembering the music and artistry of Prince. He died 5 years ago today. Now in its fourth year, the New Music Dublin Festival takes place this weekend. Online, of course, the festival is no stranger to making contingency plans. Its first outing in 2018 coincided with the snowstorm known as the Beast from the East. And this year's opening concert has been given the apt name Grounded. It will be live streamed for free from Smock Alley at 1 p.m. on Friday. It features new works from composers Deirdre Gribben and Ed Bennett. And I'm delighted that Deirdre Gribben joins us this evening from London. A title like Grounded, there are all sorts of connotations to that word, obviously, Deirdre, but in the current situation that we're all finding ourselves in. Now, I think you might have been in a slightly different situation in London, but we've been corralled within our own 5K for a while. That's lifted now. But the initial inspiration here actually came from the idea of climate change, and your piece Scattered Earth speaks directly to that.
It does. And, you know, it's a huge subject. And it's kind of very fitting. Tomorrow's Earth Day and my concert on Friday. And that's just coincidence. But there is such an awareness amongst a number of generations, especially our younger generations, about the effects of climate change. And when I was starting to write this piece, I was listening on the radio and I was hearing about the locusts. This was before the pandemic, crossing Africa and destroying crops. And I just thought it was an incredibly powerful image. And then we were grounded because of the pandemic in so many ways. And it really made me focus in on the whole idea that nature is there and it's to be cherished and cared for by us in so many ways that we're not doing. And I'm drawn to a piece about the sea. I write a lot of music about water. Maybe it's because we come from an island. I also am very reluctant to fly. I'm very aware of my carbon footprint. So this was a very fitting subject for me to look at. And I wrote my own text and also used one of my son's poems.
Yeah, I was very interested in this idea that you wrote your own text. Is that initially, was that when you say about seeing the programs and hearing about the locusts and then the pandemic itself, did you initially respond with text and with poetry, or did you start to write the poems when you knew you were working towards this piece of music?
Well, I think both, because I had just started to write the piece and the words came very naturally. I've never set my own text before, so there was something very kind of intimate about it as well, and something quite personal and quite vulnerable. The music side I'm very always very familiar with, and it's something that I do, but my text was very personal, and I look at the story of the whale, the life of the whale. The whale becomes carbon neutral and it dissolves into the seabed's floor, and you know, if we destroy the whale and through all of the kind of hunting and not taking care of the environment around the whale, then, you know, that's going to be gone, and that sort of aspect of neutralizing carbon will be gone as well. So there's a lot of things to look at in terms of climate change.
For sure. I mean, you just think, you know, what has to be said to us to say, you do know you're part of a big system here. You're only a very small cog in a very big wheel. Don't think you're in charge, because you're not. I also love the fact that you have collaborated with your son Ethan, particularly. Is this purely in terms of the text for one of the poems, Deirdre?
It is, yes. Ethan is 14 now, and he has Down syndrome, and sometimes struggles with getting his thoughts across in terms of conversation. But he has been writing poetry since he was about 9, and he had this poem, and he said, "I have a poem about climate change," and more or less presented this to me. And I've set some of his texts before, but I just find it very moving having this younger child's voice really sort of asserting something very, very profound and very mature, actually.
Yeah, will you read Ethan's text for us, Deirdre?
I will. It's called "The Last Ice" by Ethan Stein. "The last ice comes breaking, turquoise mountains crashing, broken up, lush and vibrant, blue nest hoarding secrets, moving slowly, crossing granite oceans vast beyond, horizons falling. A polar bear out on ice floe far from shore, wet and hungry. Shattered ice is melting fast. A horizontal mire of water, full to bursting. Burning liquid, ice and snow."
That's Deirdre Gribben reading song 4, which the text that will be the fourth of the four songs in her new piece Scattered Earth, which is part of this year's Dublin New Music, or New Music Dublin Festival, and the words there from her son Ethan Stein. You say he may have difficulty expressing himself in terms of speech verbally. Clearly, there are no difficulties in terms of expressing himself verbally on the page. That's an extraordinary text.
It is. And I think that it really does say a lot on a daily basis to me about our perceptions about what is possible in terms of what we think about people with additional needs. And that's just something that, you know, that I think about all the time. And I just feel very fortunate that I have this incredible artistic person in my life. His poetry is so much better than anything I could write.
Well, I also have to say it has the look of it that it might fit into a musical setting without too much difficulty. It has an innate rhythm and an innate musicality to it.
It does, and it's a very delicate song to begin with, and it's very much from the point of view of the polar bear being on its own. But the words that really struck me about this poem was the burning liquid, and that sense that the fire could get so bad that it consumes the ice and the snow, which is a complete opposite, very, very scary thought, actually.
Yeah, so four songs in total in the song cycle that you've written, Deirdre.
That's right.
Scattered Earth, and Ed Bennett's Journal Songs 2020 for voice and harp will also be performed as part of Friday's concert. Were you presented with voice and harp as the potential instrumentation here, or did you think along those lines?
Yeah.
You were presented.
No, that was the commission, and it's such a great instrument to write for, the harp and the soprano as well. And the combination is something that is a traditional 19th century salon type, but I'd never thought about just having those two instruments together, the voice and the harp. And I've really explored lots of things on the harp, references to the whale song. So if you listen in, you'll be hearing some things that are very mysterious from the instrument as well.
Yeah, because I'm bursting to actually hear some of it, but obviously this is a premiere on Friday, so...
Yeah, it is, yeah.
We haven't got any recording, you haven't got any recordings of it.
No.
As of yet. So all rehearsals, it's Michelle O'Rourke who is the... who's the soprano in this case?
Soprano.
And Richard Allen.
And Richard Allen.
Is the harpist. So is everybody, a bit like the song, the title Scattered Earth, is everybody scattered around the different corners of these islands, or where are people? How are you doing rehearsals?
I think so. We've had some Zoom rehearsals, which, you know, you just have to accept that that's what rehearsals are right now. It's been actually wonderful talking to the musicians about the structure of the work, and they've been so responsive, and Michelle's really taken it on a big journey. And, you know, she's the narrator, really. It's a very sort of dramatic piece, and I think she's really getting into the skin of it now. So, but yeah, we'd love to be there.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I wonder too, if, you know, the presumption, I've asked this question of many writers and composers and poets in particular, I suppose, the presumption is, well, you can work alone for the most part. You're sitting in your attic waiting on a bit of inspiration, or indeed a commission to come in through the door. How has work been for you in those terms, Deirdre?
Well, initially, like everyone, you know, it's a bit of a shock. And I love to sort of take my time away. I often go to the Guthrie Centre and sort of pamper myself and have a lovely sort of artist retreat time, but that wasn't possible. We were homeschooling and doing all the things that everybody was doing and walking around in circles in small parks. But it really made me focus in on just into the internal idea of what it was I was hearing. And I think the music is quite different. And I also think, because it's my own words as well, that there was something that I was just tapping into in a very holistic way. So actually, I enjoyed the process.
Well, listen, I'm really looking forward to hearing it on Friday, and thanks for being with us this evening, and congratulations to Ethan in particular on that text that you read for us as well. Thanks, Deirdre.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Deirdre Gribben there, and Deirdre's new work is called Scattered Earth. It will be performed 1 p.m. on this coming Friday, Voice and Harp. As I said, New Music Dublin runs from the 23rd through to the 26th of April, and you can find out full details on newmusicdublin.ie, and that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Gar Duffy was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGann. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RTE Radio 1.